morning, good morning. This is, so you know where you are, you're not on Mars, here at the Joint Interim Task Force on Primary and Mental Healthcare Reimbursement Task Force Meeting. I am Mary Grant, I'm a nurse practitioner and one of the co-chairs with Dr. Kincaid. Some opening comments, a couple of things, housekeeping duties. As we go through today's sort of the report that we have put together, we will be asking for comments that you may have. If you have any comments, you're to get them to Sandy by July 15th. And note that the August meeting will be the 15th. Sorry. August 15th. It's a week earlier.
Oh.
So I can, it would have been the 22nd, but.
August 15th.
And Senator Canope is asking for the call-in number, so I'm sending that to him right now.
Yes, August 15th.
You know, I'm sorry, I wasn't just paying attention. The July date's the same?
July's
No, July.
No July meeting. We'll miss you terribly, but no July meeting.
So the Zoom care presentation, that's the other.
That's the other task force.
Yeah, that's a
The work group.
Oh, you're scaring me now.
Me too.
Mobs having task force confusion.
All right. So now what we've, so today, basically, what we're going to do is talk about, and I think all of you have received a copy of this draft. Thank you. I did have a head injury.
Only can hope.
Yeah, thank you. So, anyways, so we're just going to sort of go through it. I think all of you are adults. I don't think we need to read each individual sentence, but I think what we want you to start to is to just start thinking about how you feel about and how it's been organized. Is that we did the findings and then recommendations at the end of each section.
Did somebody join us on the phone?
Senator,
no. Oh, great. Okay.
So, Dr. Kincaid, if you'd like to, since you are more familiar with this document, I'll sort of let you lead the.
Okay. What we thought would be helpful, again, our prior meetings have really been to try to understand from a primary care focus what are the challenges. We've looked at from a mental health, behavioral health focus, really tried to look at the challenges that all types of practitioners in our state are having in maintaining their practices and workforce and the economic pressures that everyone are under. We had a very good presentation at our last meeting from Dr. Gluckman to try to get a perspective looking at really some of the data related to how the insurers look at some of the challenges that we have. So we've had a very much of an information gathering in each of our four prior sessions. And so what this is an attempt to really begin to get down to the nitty-gritty. And so the way that this is formulated is the standard report that will be actually given to the legislature in November. Obviously, it started with the executive summary, and then each of the sections, what we thought would be helpful would be to walk through the findings and then the recommendations to make sure and to get comment to make sure that things were captured. Because, again, all that can be put on paper, certainly by me, is going to be something that I would hear, but obviously everybody hears something a little bit different. So we want to make sure that we get all of the perspectives and sense in each of those pieces. So we thought it would be helpful to start with the findings section related to payment parity, which was the actual original. Somebody else just join us on the phone.
Yeah, hi, this is Robin Henderson. Sorry,
technical
difficulty.
Oh, very good.
Bad number that I sent out earlier.
Okay. And it might be helpful maybe now that we've had a couple on the phone. So we have Robin and Senator Canope on the phone. Anybody else on the phone?
I'm emailing Senator Montes Anderson a correct number.
Okay, so she'll join us. And
I'm hoping.
Perhaps it might be helpful, Mary, if maybe we just make sure that the folks on the phone are aware of what other members are in the room. So start with Bob.
Yeah, so Bob Gluckman, Chief Medical Officer, Providence Health Plans.
Coralie Koning, Physician Assistant, Oregon Society PAs.
And Mary, Sandy, myself.
Mary, yeah.
John Lively, Representative from Springfield.
Janine Smith, Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority.
Ruth Bauman, Atrio Health Plan.
Great.
Folks on the phone, could you hear that okay, or do we need to adjust the mics?
I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
Great. Just wanted to make sure you knew who was actually in the room for this discussion. So we'll start, we'd like to start, and hopefully those on the phone have the document that we're going to walk through. It says draft document of the report. So we thought it would be helpful to walk through the findings section related to payment parity for physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants, and get comment or additions, subtractions, multiplications, divisions, whatever type of math you want to do. We would like to get those, and we'll chronicle those. So any comments at this point from the findings section related to payment parity? Hearing none at this point, and again, as Mary mentioned, again, it's hard to, in a meeting like this, to really absorb and comment. So we will maintain a time between now and July 15th to get additional text, comment, editing from the committee or from the task force, and those, if you have those comments, please send those to Sandy, so she will compile them, and when we come back in August, we will actually be looking and walking through a document that we can begin to vote on. So let's go to the recommendation section for payment parity. The task force recommends that the 2015 Legislative Assembly, number one, assure compliance of current statute, and number two, remove the sunset language from the current ORS statute. And then the additional comment is that the Legislative Assembly should task the appropriate regulatory body to provide monitoring of the ongoing fiscal impact of payment parity and its influence on the portion of the mental health workforce most affected to assure access to mental health care. So those are the recommendations, and so we'd like to open it up for comment, additional recommendations, and editing, et cetera. So, for the recommendation section.
I guess I'm not clear. I understand the two recommendations, one and two, but I'm still not clear exactly what the closing paragraph says. What does that mean? Pay parity and influence on the portion of the mental health workforce most affected to ensure access to mental health. I'm not clear what we're saying there.
Well, I'll just comment as during the testimony, there was significant testimony related to the effect of the economic on the economics of particularly behavioral health providers, nurse practitioners that had taken a fairly substantial reduction in their payments and what that did to their ability to provide access. We also heard from the same individuals that when that was reversed with the House Bill 2902, that allowed them to actually improve their access. So the statement was to try to understand what was truly, did it in fact do what it was intended. So if when they passed that legislation to provide that parity, did it in fact do what it was supposed to do, which was to improve access? So
I'd probably get a little clarity on a couple of points. One is there was one carrier that reduced their reimbursement, but not all carriers.
Correct.
But there was a differential that was there. But, you know, one carrier reduced their baseline.
Right.
So I do think that it's useful to have an understanding of whether this legislation has had an impact on improving access. You know, that's probably the language I would, you know, has there been any evidence that access has been improved? And then, as you've already pointed out, is there any evidence that that cost of care has been favorably or negatively impacted? You know, and one of the hopes would be was that if there's better uptake of primary care and mental health services, we might avoid more costly services elsewhere. Or did we just increase the cost of low acuity services that aren't going to generate any savings anywhere? You know, and I think that probably needs to have some transparency to it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I agree.
So.
I was just going to add that this whole section, though, about continuing what is in statute is based on a fee-for-service, not doing anything else. And it's not acknowledged in here. You have a later section on alternative payment. But really, these recommendations are based on the current way most providers are being paid, and I think we should acknowledge that's why if that's what we're recommending, that's why we're recommending, because ideally I don't think I would necessarily recommend it if it was in a different kind of payment structure, if we were paying for team-based care, if we were paying more alternative payment that was getting at outcomes. This is just a stopgap measure, I guess, in my mind, of the current fee-for-service system. But
yeah, so that's where the removing the sunset language comes into play. But we wouldn't want this legislation to preclude payment innovation elsewhere. But I think, you know, it's fair to say that if there is some evidence that shows that the acuity of the patient panel taken care of by different portions of the workforce is equivalent, and the outcomes in terms of quality and cost are equivalent, that the principle of parity should remain. On the other hand, if there are acuity differences, you know, the current system, we've also had this testimony, doesn't really reflect acuity differences as well as it needs to, and we need to ensure that patients who have just more complex illness have more resources provided for their care. That, you know.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you, I mean, are we truly recommending this or number two there? Or do you need the evaluation to truly recommend? I mean, should the, you know, we don't have enough evidence.
That's right.
No one's done the study yet. Whether this was benefit, you know, there wasn't an evaluation component to that statute. So I'm just raising that. I mean, we can certainly say this, but mm-hmm. I'm just saying that. How do you tie the evaluation? So say we're going to say to remove it, but then the evaluation says something that would make you reconsider that, legislators. or when would you want that evaluation? Is there some connection to it or not? Or is it worth the investment to really do it, or do we just move towards alternative payment and that's what you want to invest in?
Yeah, that's certainly a big question. You know, from my standpoint, again, and I appreciate and understand what we're trying to move from a standpoint of the ultimate outcomes and that. But the movement towards pay parity is where we kind of started this thing, and I understand and appreciate there's ups and downsides to that. And so I guess from my standpoint, well, that's the interim step that you talked about, that we ought to just get on with doing that, that's what we, I think we've agreed that there's reasons to do that.
Maintain,
and that's why we would get rid of the sunset at this point and still deal with the
other issues. But still continue to look at
it? Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, I obviously looking at it and seeing what the outcomes, it means we're probably going to be continuing to change course along the way, but I think that's the step, the first step, frankly, is to make that move, and then after that we'll see.
I think I agree. We're not going to stop looking at this.
No.
It is a process in motion.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's everybody's fear is that, well, once it's done, it's done. It's never done. It's not going to be done. The legislature and the people of Oregon aren't going to let that happen. So I think this is just, you know, for us to sort of say we would recommend removing it, but by no means does it stop the discussion. And by no means does it stop our continuing to look at that. There are too many groups vested in this, yeah, you know, to stop. So. But again, any other comments, be sure to get, you know, obviously we all can't write quick enough today.
So I'm still kind of, the purpose of removing the sunset language is to, is what? Why are we making that recommendation? What is it, the desired outcome of removing that? If we know we need to study this for its effectiveness, why would we remove the sunset language? Because the sunset language doesn't prevent the legislature from continuing continuing this provision, but it really does require there to be some assessment before that's done. So I actually
Well, we're still requiring the assessment, though.
I'm sorry?
We're still requiring the assessment. I mean, the assessment's going to go on.
Yes, but it would require that there be a revote to continue this. Instead of, you know, so it requires an action to say, yes, this is produce something, you know, produce the desired result.
Still require an action. I mean, if we recommend it, still requires the action for us to remove the sunset. Either way, it requires an action. Just a matter of timing when you're going to do that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And I think that was the reason for, you know, addressing that. And I think in some respects also, because it was actually a relatively small number of providers that were truly impacted, but substantially impacted, the action, again, has likely little fiscal impact, but has phenomenal sort of political impact, and that it is a vote of support for a population of providers that has been significantly challenged. So again, I think that was part of the, at least from the testimony, that was clearly came out.
Okay.
Any additional comment, Corey?
Just from our point of view, we know that the House, the 2902 will sunset in 2018, and then everything reverts back to the original pay system. So I think that's one reason why removing the sunset language is going to be helpful, right?
Any additional comment from those on the phone?
Just for those on the phone, Representative Parrish has joined us as well.
Yeah. And another beeper.
And there are there more people on the phone?
Hi, John Francis from Regents. I just called in.
Oh, yeah. Great. Thank you.
Sorry about the confusion with the code.
So I just have a quick question. We're leaving in the sunset, the removal of sunset language terms at this time, right?
Could you repeat that, Robin?
Yeah, I couldn't hear you.
Sorry, we're leaving in number two the recommendations under payment parity, correct?
We're leaving in number
we're
two.
We're leaving in the, yes. Yeah. Removing the sunset, right?
I think that was the general consensus so far. I mean, I think that the points are well taken in that do we really know it had substantial influence? I think that Representative Lively brought up the fact that we do need to understand when we legislate change things, are we actually seeing the result of that legislation? And so having the integrity to walk through and make sure that those providers are in fact have improved their access, I think that is the intention of that additional paragraph. And we can figure out if that requires other language to make that more specific or clear, and how that would be reported into what body. Perhaps we'll need to figure that out.
Before you go on, I just, luckily I have an assistant here who has informed me, we're not voting today. This is just a discussion day and recommendation day. So voting will probably not occur until September. So, because we'll have July, get the comments in, August we'll review our final recommendations, and then go from there. All right, sorry for the interruption.
Thank you.
All right.
Next section.
Yep. So the next one is the findings regarding support for primary and mental health care workforce. Again, all of you can read. you'd need to take a minute, we can do that just to refresh your...
So I did have a question about these next two sections, because there's two other competing task forces. Is there some effort made to kind of coordinate our recommendations into so that the legislature doesn't have different sets of recommendations? Because there's a healthcare workforce task force, and there's a sustainable healthcare cost task force.
Right.
And so I don't know if there needs to be a subgroup so that we actually say, how do we influence? Because what's our charge versus their charge? And, you know, I think that'd be better if the various groups coalesced around a single set of recommendations rather than three sets of, potentially three sets of recommendations to the legislature. Is that?
That makes great sense.
Absolutely.
And we can certainly do that during the month of July.
Yeah, and we may need to have some subgroup or something of if there's significant differences in the recommendations, but I just would be concerned about, what's our charge versus their charge, and,
Okay. Thank you. So the recommendations under this section, number one, support all current work of the Oregon Health Authority, Oregon Health Research Council, and other statewide initiatives and tracking provider shortage and offering options to address influencing the shortage.
So what is the Oregon Health Research Council? Because I'm afraid despite 14 years in this job, I'm not sure what it is. Are you referring to the Oregon Health Policy and Research Office, or are you referring to the... Oh, okay.
So we just got a title. That was what was on one of the documents. So it's called Health Research...
Well, I mean, support all the current work. It's actually the Oregon Health Authority, and it's the Oregon Health Policy Board we staff and support, so I don't know if that's really what you would want to put there. The Workforce Committee is under the Policy Board, so it's probably less about the particular staff and more about the policy board.
So is the task force then a sub...
The Workforce Committee of the Policy Board is in statute and reports to the Policy Board.
To the Policy Board.
Yeah.
So it's the Oregon
Health Policy Board's Workforce Committee.
And then we have the other initiatives going on that Dr. Gluckman was talking about.
Right. And I don't know whether you have a legislative workforce committee too.
Not necessarily a legislative workforce, but they bring information and recommendations to the legislature of work that those initiatives are pursuing,
Right. Because the policy board has several activities going on per the governor's task of asking them to spread the coordinated care model, and so they have several things going on, some of which I think I only touched on in my presentation, the workforce committee's work and their modeling of future workforce needs, etc.
Okay, so there's actually not a legislative task force per se addressing workforce. It comes out of the policy board.
I don't know if there is any. Bob, are you talking about a particular other group?
Okay.
There might be workforce task forces, but it may be non-medical in addition. But we have medical communities working on the shortage issue from different perspectives.
Yeah. So I would just put the Oregon Health Authority and Oregon Health Policy Board and call it good.
Yeah. All right.
Sandy, there wasn't a bill that just designated a workforce task group, task force worker.
For healthcare?
For healthcare for provider shortage.
I don't believe so. Nothing that's fallen in my lap. Not that I track every bill.
Unless there's no tele, is there a telehealth?
Well, there's telemed, but that's a different reimbursement, and that's not, I mean, there's underlying, but that's a separate.
Yes, I don't think there's an official sanctioned conversation happening around workforce shortage.
I agree.
So, it brings up a good question, is that necessary, or is the task force under the Health Policy Board adequate to address that issue? Is their charge specific to primary care and mental health services, or is it for all?
It's broader than that, although the emphasis has been, their current modeling that I think I gave you the highlights of, and I think we sent the report around, was particularly focused on primary care providers and future workforce needs. So,
okay. Thank you.
They could certainly be tasked to go deeper dives on things. I mean, it's there. That the idea, they were developed as part of House Bill 2009 and the Health Reform Bill of 2009 to specifically address workforce shortages as a contributing need, as a need in order to provide the triple aim of access, quality, et cetera.
I think in fairness, too, there's also a consistent conversation happening amongst the health care committee, both the first session I served on it, and I know that they had some in this last session, about workforce shortage and other bills around, you know, any of tax credits for rural providers. I mean, that question is constantly coming up. So I think it's something that, you know, we can certainly come back around and say, hey, we want to raise this flag again, but I think that flag is raised in the health care committee, and they are trying to find ways to address that. So,
So the next one is develop options for strategic funding partnership with health systems, insurers, and communities to provide economic incentives to practice primary care and behavioral health in Oregon, which, again, we've sort of spoken to with all the committees that are trying to expand and fund loan repayment programs to include all communities with provider shortages, increase funding for residency training programs across Oregon for physicians, primary care, behavioral health training programs for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, investigate options to remove barriers for foreign medical graduates to provide primary care and behavioral health, and mandate cost-based payment for services in support of the primary care medical home. Currently not reimbursed, including care coordinators, registry management, triage services, and phone consultation.
So I had concerns on number six. Okay. As a primary care doctor who developed a lot of these models, but the issues of mandating certain services kind of conflicts with the idea of how we're going to stem the flow of costs of total cost of care, and I think that the evidence is out still on in the commercial marketplace. I shared with Janine yesterday. I haven't seen the details of the data, but my understanding is the Oregon Health Leadership Council's high value care program that had a 2-year program embedded case managers into primary care settings didn't show any overall savings. And so I think that, this type of mandate that says these things must be covered, I also presented testimony that showed that the rate of growth in primary care services for Providence Health Plan over the last few years, which we're not unhappy about. I don't want people to misconstrue, but it is increasing at much greater rates than other healthcare services. And our percentage of premium that goes to primary care is running around 9%, and national averages are around 5%. So I just think that we have to be careful about more mandates that don't have a clear evidence to reduce total cost, unless we're going to talk about a reallocation of where services are currently of how other services are paid for, where there's a disparity, and I think that that's a case to be made, but that's not said here. So, because the money needs to come from somewhere, and if we're going to have these other mandates to try to maintain the cost of care at a rate of growth of 3.4%, sustainable growth. So I think this is where this one needs to be fleshed out: is how does this meet the overall goal of sustainability? And I think we do have to kind of recognize that there's different populations where this makes more sense than others. So on Medicaid, I think we're going to see savings, and we have already in the CCO model. And in the commercial population, where people have good social support and aren't as challenged by the burdens of poverty and have less coexisting physical and mental illness, chemical dependency and substance abuse, have had historical access to care, have higher health literacy, that some of these issues may not have the same payoff as they do in other vulnerable populations. So I think we shouldn't have one broad stroke.
And I would object to cost-based payment. I mean, that just opens the door to any expense that somebody would want to put in. And I don't think we should restrict it necessarily to just primary care medical home. That's a prescriptive model. There could be other models that for commercial population that work better. So we should have some way of tying it into effectiveness of the program and how it gets reimbursed. I also have a question on number five. We talk about barriers to foreign medical graduates, and I think we need to spell those out so that it's clear what barriers we're talking about, which would then suggest what options we might want to look at. But otherwise, it's so vague that I'm not sure it's really very helpful.
Right.
I was just going to suggest, and I was trying to find it, but there was a multi-payer agreement signed in through a group that was put together by the Health Authority and the Oregon Health Leadership Council that could probably look at those words in there around number six, because it doesn't have cost-based reimbursement. It was an agreement that they would all support the patient-centered primary care home model and start to pay differently towards it. That would include coverage for these sorts of things.
Right, but it was a fixed amount, I believe, wasn't it?
No, it was not set. We did not dictate who was going to pay what. It was just that they...
But it ended up being a fixed amount, I think, is what people ended up paying.
We don't know exactly what all people are paying. It was an agreement that moving forward through this year, they would all start to pay differently for patient-centered home. There was a health home payment that we, the state, paid that was a fixed amount.
Right.
And various plans, Bob's doing something different than some of the partners in the various pilots going on. So it was an agreement that they would all move towards a different kind of contract. And I think this bullet could reflect that agreement, because you had all the major payers at the table, OMA, OAFP, Hospital Association, the CCOs, all at the table for that.
Right, but my point was it's not cost-based.
Correct. No, I totally agree with that. It should not be. It was not agreed to be a cost-based reimbursement, because that goes kind of backwards into widget counting.
Yeah,
I was trying. I'll find the
Email
words.
Email it to me or whatever.
Yeah, I think I touched on it in my presentation, but I'll find the exact words that they all agreed to.
That's fine. Yeah, we can get it out to the group so they can see it too. Somebody on the phone wanted to talk.
I think Robin, you had a comment.
Yeah, this is Robin. I just had not specific to anyone. It's a fixed recommendation, but I'm concerned that. We've heard a lot of different models of behavioral health and primary care, many of which involve other types of providers that were not the scope of this work group. However, as we all know, recommendations like this can often be taken out of context and could lead folks to see, to the assumption that we were considering other types of providers as being providers of behavioral health and primary care. Some of you attended the conference on Friday put on by CCO Oregon that talked about the models of using psychologists, social workers, and other types of non-prescribing providers as behavioral health support within primary care. And I'm concerned that our recommendations around this area for workforce support for primary care and behavioral health don't at all mention those models and could infer that we don't support those models. So considering that these are recommendations, I think we need to make some statement that those types of models are valid and need to be fiscally supported and would be fiscally supported, because that's probably more of what's really out there right now that's making a difference. I know that's the model primarily used in Central Oregon. And there are many other areas around the state that are using those models. So that's kind of the concern I have with that section in general.
Thank you, Robin, for that. Any other, excuse me, comments? All right. We'll go on to our next one.
And while we're going on, I just want to make an announcement that this draft report is on OLIS. All you have to do is go under meeting materials for today's meeting under the task force, and the public has access. It's been available since yesterday afternoon. Thank you.
All right. So the last section is findings related to alternative payment models. this sort of scared me. It almost looked like algebra here with all the acronyms and plus one, minus two, so tried to get through it. So the recommendations were regarding alternative payment models, that we define a mandated timeline for a phased transition to a statewide, all-payer, risk-stratified global payment mechanism for primary care and integrated health, behavioral health. Set a target for total health care cost growth reduction, cumulative for all payers across Oregon, and convene a multi-payer collaborative to develop the implementation for a statewide payment reform plan for the commercial health insurance marketplace. And we do recognize the importance of introducing alternative payment methods for specialty care services, notably episodes of care, bundled payments for certain procedures, hospital services, and transitions of care. Comments?
I'm going to wait. You know, I'm trying to be polite.
Please, don't do that.
Gosh, I hope you comment.
Yeah, you better.
Yeah.
What's that?
You need to comment.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that this is really key to coordinate with the sustainable healthcare cost group, you know, because this is really their bailiwick. Mm-hmm. And we may have ideas that they didn't have, and they may have ideas that we didn't have, but I think that's the most important thing on that I would say on this statement. I mentioned to Janine, you know, just the feasibility of trying to really think a little bit about global payment mechanisms for primary care would require some way of ensuring that every patient who's insured has an assigned PCP and that we don't work with attributed models, because that's very difficult to actually make someone accountable for a patient who may or may not be their patient.
Right.
For the legislators, I'd say, is, you know, in a commercial marketplace, probably 20% of the people don't see a doctor at all. So how do you, you know, and then when they do, who are they assigned or attributed to? So this mechanism is a mechanism that is existing, you know, for CCOs and actually, you know, other payers for Medicaid. It's the an assigned mechanism. It works for Medicare Advantage. It works for the medical home products, you know, and whether it's an individual physician or a clinic, you know, just, you know, define the accountable entity. But I think it's hard to operationalize that without that. But I think the other parts of this are, you know, it would be you know, supportive of. I just think we want to have some clarity around around the recommendations, and I think that some similarity across payers so that there's a kind of a general single set of rules is a good idea. We probably should ask John if I process from Regents if I just gave him heartburn. But I think that most of us are supportive of that. What's that?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
I don't
medication.
Okay. That's different than saying you agree. But, you know,
the one point I'd make is so when you assign a member to a provider, you get a false sense of commitment, because there's oftentimes that simple act of saying that a patient's assigned to a primary care doctor doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to see the primary care doctor or that they feel a connection to that primary care. Oftentimes it's a kind of a forced relationship. I would love to see a future, and I don't know, quite frankly, if Regents or other health plans can really administer this, but something that does retain some of the positive characteristics of attribution, which is really that there is evidence of visits and commitment and patterns of care, at the same time blending in that formal commitment of assignment so that there is a defined accountability. There's probably a hybrid model that is the right approach, and I just, it's something I've been grappling with, because I'll tell you, when I worked in the 90s under the HMO model, I spent a lot of time taking unassigned members and just arbitrarily assigning them to providers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, oftentimes you get a false sense of security with that.
Yeah, no, I think there's truth to that, is how do you implement this you know, how do you implement these models. So I wouldn't make light of the challenge. But we do this in Medicare Advantage, but Medicare, again, is different because the patients actually need to go to a doctor for the most part. And in the commercial marketplace, there are many people who actually don't need to go to a doctor every year. You know, it might be every, you know, couple of years or, you know, few years, and have a source of care that, would be preferential, but they don't all necessarily say that's what I want to do. That may change some, John, with, you know, technology and video visits and, you know, other ways of accessing care that are remote, and so that they have a single place that they actually do call to access care. So I could see that that changes, but I agree with you. It's complicated, and it's hard to put it into into mandates and legislation.
I would agree with that. I mean, the 70% of the population that really doesn't need to be managed all that much supports the other 30% with their dollars. But I have a concern with mandating a timeline without some view of how that transition might happen. You know, we always forget that, you know, we have control of Medicaid members because they don't have the means to move around. Medicare members only move around a little bit more. But there are, you know, national employers that have a not insignificant number of employees in Oregon, or people who are covered by national plans because they retired from someplace else. So unless we figure out how we're going to get all those folks tied into an all-payer model, I would be hesitant to put a timeline that will force us to do something that's ill-advised just because we had the timeline. So unless we have more of a path, we know how we're going to get there. I'm a little concerned about that, about just mandating a timeline.
Comments from the phone?
Who was the one who just made the last comment?
Ruth Bauman.
Okay.
Welcome, Senator.
Yes, thank you.
All right.
Sorry about the technical difficulties.
What the co-chairs would ask is that this...
I just would love a little more input on number two. And maybe certainly from John and Bob and others who have thought about total cost of care. That also is a big kahuna. So what I would love some insight as to how, you know, because there are states that are trying to grapple with that, and what the thoughts were, again, trying to create a sustainable model of healthcare expenditure. So I'd love some additional input.
This is one that crosses with the work of the policy board with the sustainable growth rate work group that you're on, Bob, right?
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I'm on that other group, but...
You're on some group.
But I mentioned this to Janine yesterday, is that some of this is out of the control of providers, and we have to think it's a national, so it needs to be a national solution. So as an example, if I look at where are the increases in cost coming for state employees? The largest rate, I shared the, you know, for the last 12 months, almost all of the increase in cost is coming from the cost of injectable drugs and chemotherapy, cancer care.
Wow.
Now, fortunately, the cost of the care for state enrollees is well below that target right now. I mean, you know, so it's running, you know, somewhere around 1%. So we're well below. So we're able to sustain that. But I don't know that we're always going to have those kind of years. And when you're talking, you know, so, you know, one of the big crises is the hepatitis C drug. And, mm-hmm. you know, the Medicaid market can make some statements about what they want to cover or not, but that doesn't necessarily transmit to the commercial marketplace. And, you know, some of those drugs could be 1 or 2% of premium just on their own, and that doesn't leave much if you're 2.8 or 3.4 for, you know, inflation in other areas or other advances. You know, defining a specific target without having some awareness of what's actually contributing to the marketplace and what are the choices that have to be made to accommodate what I would call pricing that is irrational on the part of some in industry. Because it's, you know, the Sovaldi drug is $84,000, it's $1,000 a pill, you know, they'll sell it in another country, you know, a developed country, for $156 a treatment course instead of $84,000. And, you know, that's, you know, the cost of the Medicaid budget, if we covered everybody in, for hepatitis C, would be 90% of the entire pharmacy spend the previous year. And the estimates of California costs are more than the state would pay for K-12 education. And so, you know, those are things that I appeal to our legislators to come up with some sort of, you know, rational checks and balances in the marketplace, because that isn't sustainable. And I think that there's going to be a lot of burgeoning costs with things like, you know, personalized treatment for cancer and they're really important advances. I think, you know, the makers of the hepatitis C drug should be really applauded for something that works. Mm-hmm. It's great. But it can't cost 90% of the entire pharmacy spend. Mm-hmm. You know, now, just so I don't misrepresent anything, remember, those people are getting cured, and it's a 20-year cohort that got infected that had been waiting for treatment, so it's not year after year after year. It's a short-term, issue that's maybe a 3-5-year issue, but it's still not sustainable. And there'll be other things that come up. So that's my only comment. You asked me, what do I see as the biggest threats is how do we have some rational and fair pricing, and what is fairness as a range, and how do you determine that? And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just within the control of payers or the provider community. There's some external barriers that may make it more difficult. And then if we have this mandate, what will be the result of that? Does that mean that the providers really can't get fair reimbursement? Does that mean that other things aren't going to be covered? Or does it mean that funding for other critical programs that are not related to healthcare aren't able to be there? And so it's a complicated issue.
I would comment that in terms of the wording of it, this talks about a target for growth reduction. Do we want a target for growth reduction, or do we want a target for growth? And what do we want to tie it to?
Yeah, yeah.
Do we set a growth target, you know, the 3.4%, for example, that we're using for some government programs in Oregon? Or do you say, I want it to be inflation plus something or minus something? How that gets set, I think, will be important. I think growth reduction programs can be...
It's the rate of growth reduction.
Well, I understand what it is, but it can easily be gamed, and I'm not sure it's very comprehensible to most people.
Yeah. So the policy board has a sustainable healthcare expenditures work group that's just started. First meeting was in May. They're going to work through till November and present back to the policy board. Initially, it was to set a methodology to monitor total health expenditures and set a benchmark, but the board kind of just had them just work on the methodology at this point. So mm-hmm. we would, but then, therefore, by fall have their work, which has got health economists and others around the table. So,
great.
But the setting of the benchmark itself won't be there at that point, but something to consider.
But they would be the group that would probably have the best knowledge base to get to that place eventually.
Right.
Okay. And then you have you'd mentioned a multi-payer group.
Yes, so at this point, part of our investment through our federal state improvement model grant was to fuel this multi-payer conversation. So we partnered with the Oregon Health Leadership Council and did a focused one on primary care, which is what that consensus was that was signed last in November by all the plans and CCO representatives. They are now in the midst of the same facilitators, the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, are doing focused interviews and working with the payers about where next, you know, beyond primary care. And that work will be coming to fruition by fall as well.
And then how does that work then translate back to a legislative environment? Or does it?
Well, I mean, it always can go back to the legislative environment, keeping folks updated on, it's sort of part of a lot of things going on around improving the payment system. But I think what we promised the multi-payer group around primary care was to come back together after a year and see how these new models of care, predominantly the patient-centered primary care home, was working, so that they could see how their investment was paying off, although we don't know what each individual plan's investments are or structures, you know, to stay out of antitrust. This new conversation is more, are there other key areas that we need to collectively, payers, work together to keep, to incent better care and keep the costs down? So the feedback usually goes, gets folded back to the policy board, definitely, and the health committees as they would like to, you know, as they are thinking about these things. It's valuable backdrop to the work as they consider things. So you're not having the same conversation twice, and, you know, the learnings from that interaction with the payers is valuable to the legislators.
Great.
Anything else, Dr. Kincaid? Any other comments?
We just were wondering, for the Medicaid CCOs, and I think also in the PEP contracts, we were aiming from 5.4 trend to 3.4, so I'm not sure where the 4.8 to 2.8. It is a 2% change, but
yeah.
We started at the president's trend of 5.4.
We will make that correction. Thank you. And again, as quickly as we can all take notes, and I know this is recorded, if you have more in-depth things that you would like to see added to these recommendations, please feel free to forward them to Sandy because she loves them.
Right. Just mark away. Mark
That's
up
right.
this and send
and if
it
there's
in.
Other issues as well that you know, were brought out in testimony that aren't reflected here or things that you thought should have been part of the product coming out of this task force, then we need to make sure we know about it so that we can make sure that we include that. So,
all right. Well, the next part of the agenda is public comment. I don't know if we have anyone here.
There was a sign-up sheet, but nobody has signed up. But that doesn't mean that
you can't talk.
Right. But we have a manageable group.
I'll look at that.
No protesters.
No protesters. Oh, okay. Well, I'll review the timeline since we're there is no meeting in July. I know Dr. Glockman will want to meet, so some of us can meet with him down here.
I've got my telehealth task force, so I won't be lonely.
All right, good. Our next meeting will be Friday, August 15th. At that point in time, we will have compiled all of your recommendations, changes, editing comments to the document. We'll review it one more time. And
same time, 8 to 10.
Yes, or 8 to 5 to 9, depending on how quickly we run the meeting. Yes, thank you.
Probably the same room, too.
In the same room. And at that point, we can vote. Is that what that is?
I explained to the co-chairs that if the group is ready at the August meeting, you can start voting on the recommendations and taking official action at that point. Generally, the process involves voting on the recommendations, having those incorporated, and then voting on the report as a whole. So whether or not you're ready to vote on the report at August, possibly the September meeting, you know, whatever was unfinished in August, you can complete in September.
So I do think it's going to be important to understand how we're coordinating with the other groups.
Right, absolutely.
So I actually think that probably needs to be, I wouldn't feel comfortable voting on anything until I had some of that information.
Right.
Yeah, we'll between now and August, we'll try to get some clarity around really what are the charge of the other groups and how much of this is just sort of teeing up and supporting their work, and then how much would be also maybe additions to the work that's on their plate at this point.
And but, submit yeah, that well to me, too, so that it can be followed through and the rest of the group can respond however it's identified in the recommendation or the report. Referencing that, I'll be leaning heavily on Janine for the network that, you know, she's more familiar with on a day-to-day basis than I might be. But so absolutely.
And the goal for September's meeting, if we roll into September with this, it will meet before September legislative days.
I think it would be the Friday of Ledge Days.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Ledge Days Monday.
They're Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
You know the dates?
Well, September 19th, and I think Ledge Days is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of that same week.
Okay, so the goal is not to present this to September Ledge Days.
No.
No.
Okay.
No. I don't believe so.
I know I won't be there that day, so I'll have to do a vote by mail. in the Oregon position.
All right.
Did you mention the, and I just want to remind, comments to me hopefully by July 15th?
Yes, please.
So that gives me kind of like, you know, full 3-4 weeks that I can be communicating back and forth with folks depending on what I get and the co-chairs. Great. Anything on the phone?
Have we dealt adequately with the mental health provider issues that they seem to bring up in their email recently?
Mental health.
I understand what email you're referring to.
Yeah.
Well,
I think it was the social workers.
Yeah, I think it was the social workers and...
Did that go to the whole group senators?
No.
I was thinking that we need to maybe qualify that this group task did not address those other types of providers.
Okay.
Because I think it does cover some, but it definitely, I think, does not cover the social workers.
Okay.
I think
it doesn't cover the psychologist either, which is the point I was making earlier in the middle section, that when you use the common language of primary care behavioral health, that has meaning far beyond nurse practitioners and PAs and psychiatry. So we need to be very careful in how we use our language. And I agree with you. I think we need to acknowledge this was not the charge of this committee, but the financing of social workers and psychologists in primary care is a very critical issue that does need to be addressed.
Yeah, and if a statement could be made saying it did not address this, although knowing how important they are to the healthcare delivery system, something so that we're not...
Mm-hmm.
We haven't addressed that issue, but be clear that we're not excluding them.
Right. I think both Dr. Kincaid and I would concur that a statement could be made to that effect, that it was not the purview of this task force, but we would certainly support the ongoing work that needs to happen for those groups.
It sounds like that's more of the workforce task force issues,
right?
Because, I think the issue here was that the scope of services have more similarity, primarily because of the ability to prescribe, you know, between in the mental health fields, between the psychiatric nurse practitioners, because I actually didn't address the PAs, but could, as opposed to a different set of services where there is some overlap, but you know they're not the same. So it's a workforce issue. There's no doubt about it, and we.
But I think it's also an alternative payment approach that as you start to pay differently, you capture all the key players of that team, of which these are very important members. And so rather than, you know, continue to try to tweak a bad system of fee-for-service, it's really...
Right.
And the same with integrative medicine providers, et cetera.
I agree. Thank you for the comments. Anything else?
So can I just clarify, based on what we just talked about, that we're going to make some sort of language in that will be in this final report,
right,
that speaks to other types of providers,
right,
and the need for the legislature to come back in and have those continue to have those conversations?
Continue to have those conversations.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, something that I think we recognize is really important, and that discussion needs to continue.
Well, and some of those groups have been waiting for a long time. I mean, at least the 4 years I've been here, they've been waiting for that conversation. So to the extent that we can recognize that and then task the healthcare committee to you know, at least back around and say, okay, it's time to take that next step
right.
and have that. I mean, really, the legislature needs a subcommittee on scope of practice for an entire session and just bang it all out and not do this ones and twosies, but...
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in charge of the healthcare committee, so
you can give them work and not have to worry about it. All right.
Give me more work.
Okay. Dr. Kincaid, or
my favorite subject.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other comments from the phone? Okay. Seriously. All right. Meeting adjourned. Have a nice July.